All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We are recording this in early January for a mid-February release. We are in the middle of the Krakoan era, giant-sized new X-Men, and today we're going to take a dive into a 2009 book called X-Men Origins Wolverine by Chris Yost and Mark Teixeira. We'll get there in the latter half. You'll see the tie-ins very quickly. Wolverine's a pretty new character for our listening audience, at least, but of course, a tremendous fan favorite for people all around the world. I'm so excited to be welcoming my dear friend Gregory right back to the show, and today we're going to be featuring the incredible talents of the wonderful penciler Jeff Isherwood. Jeff is going to be doing a moonstone for my wall, which I'm so excited about. I can't wait to show everybody. Let me have you introduce yourselves. Let us know your name and pronouns. Tell us a little bit about your comics history.
Hello there. Yes, Jeff Isherwood, and my pronoun is he, me, I, it. Just me. That's good enough. However, I'm quite familiar with pronouns, having taught myself at college for about 8 years. And so that has become a very pronounced thing to do, which is good, because I always said to my kids, I don't care what your background is. I'm here to help you become an artist. That's the number one thing. And I liked everybody. I started working at Marvel way back in 1982, a couple of stories, went back in the spring of 83 when nothing further came of it, and was able to land work with Ralph Macchio as editor on a Daredevil story. That went well, and so I kept getting assigned more. So I was working full-time in comics for about 17 years. In 99, when I was working on Conan the Barbarian, the three-issue miniseries they were running, that character, the licensed character of Conan, was dropped by Marvel. So that ended my primary comic book career, working for the large two companies or Dark Horse or anything. So therefore, I had to shift gears, and I was able to slide sideways artistically into the film and TV business. And so I worked on over 85 productions, something like that. Usually smaller jobs, but a couple of large ones, a couple of X-Men films, Days of Future Past and Apocalypse. More recently, this past year, I was able to speak to the people over at Heroic Signatures and Titan and have drawn two issues of the new Savage Sword of Conan, issues 5 and 6, a 96 pages of King Conan story, which written by Jason Aaron, should open a few eyes as to little surprises that, well, of course, you have read it by now, everyone, but surprises and what could be done with the character. So interestingly enough, it is 25 years between Conan jobs for me, and it was fantastic to get back to it. It felt just like riding a bicycle, you know, just back in the saddle and go. So that was wonderful, and I'm looking forward to doing more.
My name is Glenn Hurdling. My pronouns are he, him. I have been in the industry. I started in actually 1986. I left in 96, but I've been following comics, you know, here and there a bit. Not on the minuscule level that you have, Chad, but, you know, I'm still a very big Hulk fan. I pick up a lot of the Hulk-related stuff. That's where my interest started, and that's why I was a big Wolverine fan, because Wolverine made his first appearance in the Hulk.
Gregory Wright, my origin story goes back to, you know, being hired at Epic Comics, you know, with Joe Duffy and Archie Goodwin and D.G. Chichester and Margaret Clark. I moved on to Mark Gruenwald's office as the assistant editor, where I learned to be really anal retentive continuity, which is where you and I kind of crisscrossed, because I worked on the Handbook of the Marvel Universe, which is, as you well know, is quite a thing. From there, I became an editor of Epic and Marvel Comics, caused a tremendous amount of haywire, moved on to freelance work, writing things like Deathlok and Silver Sable and Morbius, and have colored just about, I don't know, every single character or comic. Did all those Marvel DC crossovers that worked for every single company. And, you know, when all the young punks came in and took all the work, all of us old fogies kind of got shoved aside. So I do a lot more independent work.
There's a trope in American fiction, worldwide fantasy fiction, where we kind of go back to, and I'm going to give it the really annoying academic lens for just a moment. We go to the back to the concept of colonialism. We take like the white British guy and we toss him into the jungle or under the ocean or on the foreign planet. And he's able to thrive by his own, you know, muscles. And he kills the beast with the sword or the gun. And he builds the fire and he fucks the girl and he becomes the king. And there's like that trope in fiction that exists so often in so many of the characters that we love. Jeff, you have a gorgeous ability to draw like epic fantasy. We're opening with kind of Conan the Barbarian, who's kind of the ultimate version, right? Like we make him the king, we give him the beautiful girl, he fights the giant monster or the evil sorceress. But when I see the way you approach those types of pencils, if we compare that just very simply to your work with Namor the Submariner, which is a very different version of that, we toss it underwater or we throw it into outer space. You move a lot of environment and like big action together in the work. As I review your work, your Doctor Strange stuff is a kind of a different category in my mind, but the way that you put all of this together, tell us a little bit about how you approach high adventure stories from an artistic perspective and how you make those work for you.
Well, a lot of it has to do with also approaching from the writing side as well. So I find all this has just become sharpened from film work, where a lot of this has, you know, the same thing, right? To me, it's about the character. I see each character as an individual and they exist in their environment, their world. And that environment and world is very important to help show psychologically where they are at, physically first, where they are. And so it's all part of genre, right? So if you're doing science fiction, do you like doing the spaceships and outer space stuff? So, or Conan, for example, you know, it's that ancient world. So it's sort of medieval, it's sort of prehistoric, but it has to be its own thing somehow at the same time. So you want to be able to place the character in that world with Submariner, with Namor, it was, you know, undersea, and a lot of it's there. And so again, that in a way is a very alien world for us surface dwellers.
The underwater drawings are more akin to outer space almost than they are to like epic fantasy. It's interesting.
There are time constraints because we have to get these things finished. At the same time, as long as there is enough background to create, so the reader just knows where things are occurring. I learned a lot about storytelling from Larry Hama early on. And he was saying, you know, you have to set up scenes with that, what he called the chessboard shot, and a high overhead down, you know, at an angle. So you get to see the environment where the characters are spatially compared to each other. You sort of set up blocking the scene, as you would call it in film. And therefore the reader knows where they are there and they understand that. And then you can put the camera anywhere you want. It's great because then you can go to tight close-ups or raking angles or anything you want because they know, oh, well, I'm in this warehouse. I'm in outer space. I'm under this undersea base. Doesn't matter. In terms of character, though, again, characters are generally archetypes of behavior patterns and emotions. So they may appear as fully formed actual human beings, but they're not. They're still characters. So they each represent these different behavior patterns, personalities. So, you know, I always use the obvious answer is, who is the Hulk? Well, he is just embodies unbridled rage and anger, and he just wants to destroy things. And people can relate to that because it happens to us on occasion. Somebody cuts us off in traffic. Somebody bumps you on the subway. Somebody says something nasty on your Instagram, whatever, and you just want to take them and you just want to squash them, right? It's just this primal animal behavior that humans still have in us ancestrally, and going back in terms of evolution to just the idea of simple survival, right? So, but we understand that, right? So every type of emotion you get, all different types, you embody all those in your different characters. So to be able to draw these stories well, it really, to me, always starts with the character, and then everything grows out of that. So the environment you place them in is an outgrowth and helps cement in the viewer's mind what they're all about. You know, a character who's this nasty, dirty street character, he lives in that world. He doesn't live in some, you know, Beverly Hills rich mansion. He's down in the gutter and graffiti on the walls and broken down buildings and dirt and grime and stuff. That embodies also what's in that person's mind, that character's mind. So then you just understand that world and where they're coming from. That's, you know, that type of example. example. So we always have to sort that out ahead of time. And then, of course, you know, how we respond to things first is just visually. You can see a picture of someone and you kind of determine in your own mind, do I like this person or not? They haven't even spoken a word. You may not even not know them personally, but we have a very quite a visceral visual response to everything. Then you can get further in if you hear them or you see them, and then you can start to determine whether you like that person or not. So all of this kind of psychology goes into the characters, and then that grows out into the backgrounds, and especially in terms of color, the color of the background of a scene makes a big difference. And when you switch scenes, you want to change the basic color pattern to maybe like a warm color, to a cool, dark interiors, to light out exteriors. It's a lot like film, but comics, of course, as a compressed form of storytelling, means you have to incorporate all this right away, very quickly. And in terms of character, you have to be able to establish character very fast. You know, the first two word balloons out of a character's mouth, the things they say, you have to understand who they are fast. You don't have time for that slow burn because you don't have a lot of pages. So all of this kind of information goes into writing the story and then art drawing the story from both sides. It's really quite an equal approach in terms of creativity. All of this has to be understood so that we can get the ideas out there and get the reader to understand very fast what's going on. And just in terms of background, it takes much more time to add a lot of background, takes more time, more thinking time and creative time to put into exactly what to put there. But at the same time, it really helps the overall feel.
I love when I hear a writer or an artist that kind of compares the experience of making comics to operating a camera or being like a film director. You know, we got to set up the angle, get the shot right, make sure the lighting is in place, makeup. Okay, now let's go. I think it's really fascinating to think of like action and environment in those types of terms. You mentioned you worked on the X-Men films a little bit. This is an X-Men show. I'd love for you to share with our listeners a little bit about your experience there.
Well, living in Montreal, Quebec, I started working on films at the end of the 90s on the wonderful John Travolta masterpiece, Battlefield Earth.
That might be the coolest thing I've heard all day.
Oh, you know, the interesting thing was I had just real quick, comics work had really dried up, and I'm thinking, I got to find something fast. I'm not getting a response from anybody. The comics business had shrunk a lot, as Greg has mentioned, you know, like that things really were crunched down. And so I found in Montreal that film productions were starting to pick up. Found, oh, there's this Battlefield Earth thing starting up. So I had to find the production office, try and get an interview. I really knew nothing about it, you know, from the inside. So I was able to get an interview with the production designer, Patrick Titopoulos. Now, he had done Independence Day, the design on that, and also the revised, was it Godzilla 98? Like the different looking Godzilla? So he was a hot property. I was tacked on to the end of six other people who were interviewing for a concept art job. And so I went in to see him. And the funny thing is he'd interviewed a couple people I'd been to university with later on. Anyway, I was the seventh person. He talked to a bunch of others, and I come in, I said, I've never worked on a movie before, but here are a bunch of comics. And of course, what did I have drawing in them? Backgrounds. So I had to find, you know, some Namor stuff, Conan, you know, the various things. And I'm trying to think what looks science fiction-y. It could have been a Swords of the Swashbucklers as well. It's very likely. So I just brought him some of those that had some background drawings and some sets, because I knew we were talking probably set design. He's a French fellow. His Greek name, French fellow, lived in California, and he goes, I love you comic book people. You can draw anything. You are hired. Like, boom. It's like, oh, cool. This is great. Got started on that. I worked there for 3 months. So he taught me a lot about concept art for sets and what have you, and for costume and for prop design and designing anything. He taught me a lot himself, because he himself is an artist, a very good artist. But he just told me at the time, at the interview, he was just swamped with too much to design. He was supposed to handle all the costumes, all the set designs, everything, right? He couldn't do it all. And as a production designer, you're in meetings with people, you're going over budget with how much can we afford, and, you know, just goes on and you don't have much time to be actually creative. Many years later, I was asked by a woman, Claire Allery is her name. She was the prop master on Battlefield Earth. Now, jump ahead, what was it, 2013? About 14 years, she called me again to do prop design on X-Men Days of Future Past with Brian Singer as a director. Now, I had met Brian briefly before on, he was going to direct the movie Confessions of a Dangerous Mind in Montreal, but that project got shut down after about 3 weeks and they went elsewhere and he went on to something else. And that happens a lot. But during that meeting, Confessions, I was able to talk with Brian about X-Men. And I was talking with him, asking him, you know, it's like, what's the thing? You know, we were just discussing that, me being drawing comics. And he was saying, well, you know, for me, the idea of the mutant characters is metaphorical for gay people as being, you know, misunderstood and maligned and what have you, and yet still strong and powerful and being able to, you know, to get on with their lives and do great things. So great. I think that was the first time that idea of that metaphor came across. And I thought, well, you know, that makes a lot of sense. I was doing storyboards for him. Well, I did prop design and then storyboards on Days of Future Past. And I remember being in the art department, simply talking to a bunch of people who I knew already from other shows, just saying, superheroes is not science fiction, really. Superhero comics are different. It's a different animal. So the mindset of designing and coming up with stuff has to be different because it's that, you know, that heroic, there's the heroic fantasy element. It's all kind of things mixed together, but superheroes are different. On that show, I designed the Cerebro. I mainly did a lot of storyboards that designed the Quicksilver slow motion scene. Mm. When he's in the kitchen and he's fighting, everything is slow motion. I did the first pass on that one.
That's so cool. It's so visually cool.
That's such a great sequence.
Yeah, I loved when it came out. I didn't realize, like, the idea that of Brian having it like that circular kitchen design, like in 2001, that was something he came up with after the fact. But a lot of the specific actions I did because we had a very sketchy script to work from. It was always a work in progress, and Brian tinkers a lot. He never really satisfied with something, just we write it and we film it like this, boom. He's always trying different things. When I was watching him film a couple of scenes, one with Apocalypse with the four X-Men characters in the corridor there, he had Oscar Isaac do his dialogue slower. He had the camera movement done differently, you know, pause and then move in right away, telling him to turn and speak to the other actors at a certain point back. You know, he would change a lot of things. It's not that they'd done anything wrong. He just wanted to give his editors a lot of options so it could play as well as possible later. That was fascinating.
There's something so fascinating about how the environments, focusing on that for a moment, become characters in the story. You talk about Cerebro, whether it's the old, you know, like little helmet that Xavier put on, or the more expanded, like giant circular chamber with the paneling all around that they used in the films that makes it into the comics. The Danger Room, the X-Mansion. Gregory, I'm thinking of all those schematics from the handbooks where we would like draw the little layouts of the buildings or the Sentinel armor, how everything cuts apart. And then we take our heroes and we toss them into these different environments. Greg, if you're coloring the Savage Land versus Jeff, if you're drawing, you know, Conan versus a giant snake in the desert, like these environments and the ways we toss our heroes into them and how they adapt is such a huge part of the action and adventure. Gregory, I know you've done a lot of coloring over the years. What are environments that you both hate or love to color?
You know, it's interesting because, I mean, everything Jeff has said is the stuff I would echo it. It's all, he's 100% right. But, you know, I came from film school and I came from a cinematography background. So when I started to color, you know, most of the comics at Marvel were being colored where they just colored all the characters their normal color. And then they put that fucking lime green or purple or pink background down that didn't, that just looked like shit. And oddly, one of the comics that did usually look pretty good was Conan. For some reason, you know, I think George Russo's was coloring that and it looked better because he wasn't putting, you know, pink rocks. You know, they look like rocks, and when it was night, it looked like night. But when I started coloring, for, you know, when I stopped imitating other people, because, you know, my first coloring jobs were, you know, filling in for every other colorist. And sometimes it was great. Christy Scheel was always great because she was doing something interesting, and Glynis Ween Oliver was also nice. But when I started doing it, I wanted to treat it like a movie. And my favorite cinematographer at the time was a man named Vittorio Storaro, who shot the Godfather film. And one of the things that he did was, Jeff was talking about it, really trying to use the color for each scene. Sometimes it's easy, daytime, nighttime, or whatever. But I used to, you know, come up with a color palette for every single scene so that they look different. And the issue was trying to come up with a color palette that not only look good, but actually had some kind of a point for the scene. When you're working with writers and artists that are doing interesting stories, it's easy. Like Batman, it's so easy to do that. Westerns are usually pretty easy to do that stuff. But, you know, there's a lot of writers that they're not really writing comics. They're writing, you know, some kind of stupid ass television show as a comic book. So you wind up with all these scenes of people in broad daylight sitting around in living rooms wearing regular clothes or going to the mall, and you kind of have to just color it normal. And I fucking hate that. It's like when I did like Marvel DC, I had to color every single character in both universes, but there was interesting scenarios. So I was able to figure out, how am I going to use the thousands of colors for the stupid characters as well as for the backgrounds? But because the writers and the artists did a really great job of creating a lot of times environments that don't actually exist.
Yeah, that's a beautiful book, by the way. That's a gorgeous book.
I could go in and I said, okay, I'm going to decide this color that will allow me to color this jelly bean of characters at the same time providing something. For me, it's all about the color storytelling. When I took on Batman with Kelly Jones, I told the editor, I said, I'm not going to color anything normal. He says, what do you mean? I said, I'm not coloring Batman this color. I'm not coloring any of the characters. I'm going to change their colors. And I said, everything's going to be based on whatever the light is happening. Because Kelly's art, it's just so expressive. There's a lot of black, so there was a lot of room to play. So, you know, you had green and brown and, you know, pink Batman based on the light, which was based on the story that they were telling, based on the scene that was happening. And Denny had called me at one point. I don't know if Kelly drew it. And he had said, this page has got scenes in two different places. Can you do something? Because it doesn't look like that in the art. And I said, Denny, I said, I've already done it. And I said, you know, one scene is blue and one scene is yellow. I said, it'll be, and he goes, oh my God, that's so perfect. And, but, you know, he was aware that that was an actual just need. But I'd already done it, because that's my thing. That's what I do.
Jeff, one silly question for you, and then we'll get back to craft again. Given this era of American politics, how does it feel to be the co-creator of the Marvel character, the Trump?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think he was actually turned out as some kind of, you know, trickster charlatan. I think it's pretty much the same.
The Trump is a very silly Daredevil villain named Carlton Sanders, who's like a stage magician in a cape. He's only shown up in comics a handful of times. Go look at the Marvel appendix if you like. But just
he showed up again.
Okay. Character. Yeah, he's a Grunwald used him in like a handful of like Captain America issues, and I think in one issue of like Star Blast or something. He's a weird one for sure.
Well, as a character who, as a villain, he has a different name. And of course, as a real person, you know, his real German back name is Drum. So, you know, it's also been a changed name. So there you go.
There are massive differences in superhero stories, depending on the type of story we're told. If we do a single comparison of a solo character versus a team book, those are obviously very different things. But that Conan template that we've been kind of revolving around, that like really rough guy who's like rising up and like fighting against depression and being the man's man, that's a template that we see so frequently, whether it be Clint Eastwood in Westerns or, you know, John Blaze, the Ghost Rider, you know, balancing hell inside of him while, right, you know, riding around, versus the Punisher, versus even Thor or Namor, these kind of templates as the big tough guy on the epic adventure. We see this in films all the time. Gladiator just had kind of a new resurgence. You know, the guy loses everything. And there's kind of a through line. We see writers like Jason Aaron and Ben Percy do a lot with these types of characters where we really explore them. But really, ultimately, it lands in a place of, I just want to like have the love of a good woman, and I want to like have a peaceful life, but I keep getting drawn back into the action. And there's the blood spatter when the gun is fired or the sword is used. You know, there's these common tropes. Wolverine is that character for the X-Men. Wolverine is that one guy who, he comes out of that like post-Vietnam mental struggle era of PTSD, and I don't know my past, and I have to fight for these causes with these claws that come out of my hands, and I just want the good life. Now, he's a mutant hero also, obviously, but he's the one character in the X-Men franchise, outside of characters like Cable or Deadpool, who are different versions of that, who who has that kind of gritty, rough and tumble adventure. Are the two of you Wolverine fans? And is this a character that you have worked with much? Let's go Jeff and Egg. Oh, sorry.
I've never written Wolverine somehow. I've colored him in things. Problem is for me that he's just so overused that I never really could think of a story to tell with him that would be worth my time because everybody else was already telling them. And, you know, again, he was an ex in the ex-office, so you couldn't really do much with him. So if I put him in a story, the amount of restrictions I would have on what I could do with him made it not worth, you know, doing. I liked reading him, you know, especially when, you know, Chris Claremont was writing the Wolverine stuff. I think nobody really wrote Wolverine, except for Larry Hama. Larry and Chris, I think, really sort of understood that character very well. And I got to paint blue lines over John Buscema on a Wolverine Nick Fury graphic novel that Tom DeFalco kind of plotted with John. He scripted it. But that was a lot of fun. You know, that was back in when Wolverine was in his patch days, I guess.
Chris gives us a really strong Wolverine, like as the tortured veteran. He's like the man's man with the heart of gold with the berserker rages, right? Hama takes that character all over the place. Wolverine as a pirate, Wolverine in space, Wolverine underwater, Wolverine in hell. Like Hama gives us this like very Wolverine in every environment version. Jeff, you were just showing us earlier a drawing of Wolverine you're currently working on. What's your connection with this character?
Again, I've been reading him from the outset, naturally, because we're of a certain age. Doctor Strange, when I took over the book, I was, Mike Rockwood said, Butch Geist isn't drawing the book anymore. And I said, can I draw it? And he said, yeah. So, you know, that was one. And it's funny, there's Strange, but the reason I went to Marvel in the first place is because I wanted to draw Conan. I always saw Conan more as a like a real person compared to other superheroes, although I enjoy all superheroes. It doesn't matter. Roy Thomas was saying, you know, let's bring in some other characters to try to get more readers into reading Doctor Strange as sort of a B-level character or something. So we had Wolverine appear in one of the early stories that I did. And that was a lot of fun because I get to draw the guy, you know, I get to try to put him in, you know, get him, put you know, what I know of the character and get him involved in the story and, you know, a very diametric opposite sensibility to Dr. Strange. So that was a great contrast. But one thing I remember about John Buscema says he, and I think Larry did tell me this, is that he loved drawing Wolverine because that was his modern world version of Conan. And John loved doing Conan. John really was not a big, didn't really enjoy drawing superhero stuff in general. That wasn't his, you know, he did tons of them, but it wasn't his favorite thing. It was a job. Wolverine, and I guess in his civvies and stuff like that, he really enjoyed the Logan side of it. And so, and that's the thing about Wolverine is his world is it's the superhero world, but it's still very much our regular normal world in a way. And here he's dropped in as that person, that war veteran who's come back, and the war veterans we have, who so much of their life has been in the military, their experience is so diametrically opposite to civilian life. Again, I refer to Larry again, a story he was telling, he's saying, if one veteran's talking to another, and he said, he was saying, it's very difficult to describe things that happened, experiences, because he said, well, if you're talking to another veteran, you don't have to give them chapter and verse, because you can say one little sentence, and they get it because they lived it. He says, otherwise, you can do a long description, but until if you've never lived it, you can kind of get it, but you don't really. That's the idea of Wolverine. So the idea of him being rebuilt, being made into this super soldier character, it's like really an update on the old Captain America, right? The Canadian version, except he doesn't play hockey for some reason. Maybe he does. The idea is that he's always set aside. He's different from the rest of the X-Men. He's not mixed in, you know, he's always, and he sets himself aside. And they always see him as that too. He's not, you know, he's like that feral cat you bring into your house. And you're thinking, I can feed him. And yeah, he seems pleasant most of the time, but you just never know when he's going to turn around. And
go back to my review of the first appearance of Wolverine, which was on my show a few months back with Paul Jenkins and Erica Schultz. I give like an 11-point treatise about what makes this character really unique. Now, ironically, much as Greg said a moment ago, I'm not a big Wolverine fan, but making this show is turning me into a Wolverine fan, which is kind of crazy to me. Wolverine is 5'3". I hate when artists draw him like really tall and massive. It really annoys me. He's in bright yellow. He's named after a creature that we don't really think about, and he has claws coming out of his heads. He's kind of crazy here. Glenn, are you a Wolverine fan? And if so, what do you love about this character?
I am a Wolverine fan. I've been a Wolverine fan since one of the very first comic books I ever picked up was Hulk 181. So that was, you know, the introduction to Wolverine, and I've been a fan ever since, you know, and that I waited for so long to find out whatever happened to this character. And it was another friend of mine who told me, Glenn, he's in the X-Men. I'm like, yes. So that's when I started picking up the X-Men. And yeah, I love the character, you know, just going to what Jeff was saying, you know, the feral cat. I've always seen him as the noble warrior. You know, he's just, you know, he's got so many different sides to him, and there's so many different aspects to his personality.
There's that samurai side too. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You have, you know, just there's just this noble side to him, and yet this feral side to him. And it's just like, what Wolverine are you going to get at any particular time?
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.
When you jump into Giant Size X-Men number one, Wolverine's history is only a couple of issues old. He was in those two issues of Incredible Hulk, basically as a government asset for the Canadian government. Kind of he's being pushed into doing things he doesn't really want to do. They call him Weapon X. Xavier shows up in Giant Size X-Men number one and recruits him from there. Wolverine turns on his commander, cuts off his tie, and is like, what are you going to do about it? And then he leaves with Xavier. The issue we're going to review in a minute picks up on that scene, which is why we're spending a little time with it here. Now, Wolverine's in the X-Men for a period of time. It's 1975, up until kind of the early 80s. He's one of the most popular characters on the team, slowly increasing in popularity. And then the early 80s, Chris gives Wolverine his first four-issue limited series, which later then turns into the long-form series, the one that Larry Hama takes over. And he's basically had a comic book at Marvel ever since. Now, his origins are almost hilariously complicated because people like to just stack and stack and stack and stack on them. Now, it's in Marvel Comics Presents, which people in this room may be familiar with, where we have a Barry Windsor Smith story that really delves into Wolverine's experiences at Weapon X, where it's this kind of very psychedelic, bloody, naked government experiment craziness, where we learn the story of his adamantium, and it's very long form. Glenn, I know you have opinions on that story.
The artwork was incredible, right? But just talk about convolutedness.
Terry Cavanaugh was pumping that book out just like crazy.
Just at least you had that coming, you know, every week. But it really wasn't until you collected it that you could see where it went awry. And just when you're looking at Barry's work, it's just, I just love looking at it, you know. So, but the story, it was very convoluted.
So a few years after Claremont took over X-Men, there's a story where Alpha Flight, the government operatives from Canada, come to reclaim Wolverine for Department H. And this is where we start to see he has a backstory with Mac and Heather Hudson. The Weapon X stuff a few years later is what gives us the prequel for that. He's in the experiments, he gets the adamantium, he's on the run, and then Heather finds him in the wilderness. But it's later stories that start to give us versions of Wolverine that were like soldiers in previous wars. We have a symbiote Wolverine at one point. We have Wolverine in the past, Wolverine living in Japan and training as a ninja, Wolverine having love interests and children with different people. But his memory has been fucked with so much that he doesn't know what his origins are. So the character that we meet at the beginning of Giant Size X-Men is one that has no recollection of his past. As far as the readers know, the adamantium is part of his, you know, mutant powers at this point. But it gets expanded on and expanded on and expanded on. Now, fast forward to 2005, Brian Michael Bendis gives us the House of M storyline, where at the very end, Wanda Maximoff says that, like, no more mutants, and then everybody gets restored, right? When the mutants come back, there's only, like, 200 mutants left, and the entire population of mutants across the planet has been wiped out. But one of the weird side effects of that spell is Wolverine got his memories back. So this mystery of this character that had been existing for decades is now suddenly being actively explored. And there was a series called Wolverine Origins that is taking the character through modern stories, but exploring all the complexities of his background all at the same time. That all comes out right before the issue we're about to review, which was revealed in 2009. So there's a ton of Wolverine stuff that's still being explored, but we now are dealing with a character that has full access to his memories. What are your thoughts, Greg and then Jeff on the idea of Wolverine as that character who didn't know his past, and then suddenly modern readers have full access to it.
It's fucking stupid. You know, the part of the thing that made Wolverine more interesting was him not really knowing. You know, I mean, that's fascinating. And, you know, for a while, you know, you got little pieces that you would get when, you know, from Chris Claremont. And even in, you know, the Weapon X, it was suddenly, oh, this is exciting because this is new. And then all of a sudden now he remembers everything. And it's all this crap that people have dumped on him, loaded on him. Some of these stories are stupid. And so he's not very interesting anymore. All of the mystery of Wolverine is now gone. We've all read it, but now he knows what's going on. So, you know, he should be able to say, oh, okay, and just move on and be done. He didn't know, am I a good guy? Am I a bad guy? What, who am I? You know, and he was trying, that was his thing. His thing was trying to figure out, who am I?
Now, Paul Jenkins, who I've befriended through the show, which is wonderful, did that Wolverine origin story, which takes Wolverine back to his very early days in like Victorian Canada, you know, where he is the little kid whose claws pop and there's the big mystery about everything that got set up.
Very much with Greg on this. And I think in a larger sense, it's a problem where you have characters that are around for so long. New stories being done. Editors come in and they bring in writers, and writers always want to have, often, well, I'll have to talk to Glenn about that. But, you know, everybody's got their own ideas on how they'd like to approach something. And with different creators coming in, it's inevitable you're going to have all these different changes come in. And so, you know, different pasts and different histories and what have you. But the idea of there being mystery, I like. It's a couple of examples. Tomb of Dracula. Did Gene Colan ever give you a nice full-on, fully lit base of Dracula? No, he did that on purpose. It was always half lit. You get a piece here and there. You never see the full thing on purpose. It's like Alien, the first Alien. What the hell is this creature? And then all of a sudden it's revealed and it's like, well, the fun's gone out of it. So what, right? And that's the problem with these things. And you look at, but go to cartoons. Take any of your favorite cartoon characters, like your Charlie Brown, your Garfield, or what have you. They're always still that same character that they always have been. And they're not Calvin and Hobbes. Not trying to turn them into something else. They don't have to age. They don't exist in real time. This is something I find that a lot of fans or try to do, or studious people try to do, is to create a full chronology and pull a full life as if these characters are real people and they have this actual history. It's not really true. And they're not really designed as such. They're not supposed to be that. And so you're trying to put a template of one thing over a different thing. It's trying to fit that old square peg into a round hole. And so what happens with Wolverine in this case is that, you know, you're giving him all these, or the writers giving him all these different pasts. You know, it's like filling out his life. Fine. Here's one way I did like it. The Blacklist show. Don't know if I've watched the entire series of The Blacklist more than once. And I love the way Spader would, you know, he's obviously been out of circulation for, say, 30 years. And he would refer to something. Oh, do you remember that time in Vienna when we went into that cafe and that such and such? He would just give little hints to his past. So it would flesh out the past without everything having to be revealed. Also, the idea of Wolverine not having a memory is always fascinating, because there with all kinds of shows, characters that have some type of amnesia, and we know, but they don't. And there's always that dynamic, which in terms of the type of story is always fascinating. It goes counter to the type of story where there you have the Reddington character does know everything and we don't. So they only reveal little bits and pieces that help the story and only tell you what you need to know, right? But when it's the flip side of the coin, it's like, are they ever going to find out? And if they don't, you see that's a puzzle piece of their life that is missing. We know about, but they don't. And so that creates a little bit of unrest in the viewer, and I like that idea too.
It's interesting though. I'm thinking of the show Lost as an example. If you guys watched Lost was so steeped in complex mysteries, and every time they'd reveal something, there'd be another big mystery around the corner. And finally, when it's all revealed, it's kind of not super satisfying at the end for a lot of people. But I'd be more annoyed if we never got it, because there's an end to the story. With Wolverine, he was so firmly in just Chris Claremont's hands for so long. And then Larry Hama joins, the X-Men office expands. Suddenly we jump to the 90s and there's multiple books and he's showing up all over the place. And this is where Greg mentioned at the beginning, like this character's so oversaturated, we get exhausted. He gets video games, he gets a movie franchise. He's the lead character in the cartoon. We're now in the early 2000s and the Wolverine book alone is being written by certain writers, the Origins book by another writer. He's also part of the main X-Men team and he's being used by other writers in other books. So there's a lot of pieces that get all put together. Jim Zub, if you guys know Jim Zub, did a Wolverine kind of comprehensive origin for the Marvel Infinity comics a few years back where he tried to stack it all up in one place. And when I talked to Jim, he's like, it was such a headache to put it all together, but it's just so complicated. I'm pleased to have the answers, but also they're super not satisfying. For example, we're not going to talk about the history of Adamantium today or Romulus or even the complexity of the Weapon X project and how it's become like there's like 16 Weapon X's, but also it's Weapon Plus, not Weapon X, or Weapon 10, depending on how you read the X. And so many people have played with these that it gets almost exhausting at a certain point, but there's also some really amazing stories along the way. We're going to keep today's conversation focused primarily on the content related to the issue we're going to review and how it shows up and connects to Giant Size X-Men number one. The last piece of continuity I'll toss at you really quickly. Mike Carey was writing a book during this time, just before this issue we're about to read came out, called X-Men Legacy. It's exploring the early days of Charles Xavier and really examining a lot of the complexities of that character. There's a story called Original Sin that takes place shortly before this. The premise is Nick Fury, who's another one of those Conan templates in his own way, murders Uatu the Watcher on the moon and plucks out his eyeballs. And the eyeballs end up on Earth and they basically explode. And everyone who's around the eyeballs learns a secret about their origin that they didn't know. So there's this whole Marvel event called Original Sin going back into the past. One of the things that's revealed during that storyline in the Professor X Wolverine kind of team up that's happening between X-Men Legacy and Wolverine Origins is that back at the beginning, when Wolverine was really first joining the X-Men, he was having violent tendencies. Xavier examined him, realized that his memories were struggling, and Xavier in some capacity suppressed those memories so that Wolverine wouldn't feel so complicated and also kind of amped up Wolverine's dedication to being one of the X-Men. And at the end of this story, Wolverine's learning this about his past and he basically thanks Xavier, like, you gave me a sense of purpose, you made me a hero, but also you fucked with my brain, so that wasn't super cool. So that's kind of taking place all before we get to this particular issue. There's a ton happening, so a book with the name Wolverine Origins on it is already very complicated.
I did not know that. I mean, I've seen that in the movies and, you know, where in other areas where his brain, where Professor Xavier had actually suppressed his memories and trying to do good. And so, you know, you have that dichotomy of, well, is this a good thing that my memories were suppressed so I could go do good? Or is it a bad thing that you fuck with my memories? You know, so that makes good tension. That makes a good story, that whole kind of conflict. So that's interesting.
The book we're about to read is called X-Men Origins Wolverine. It was one one-shot released among a lot of others. There's a bunch of X-Men Origins book that were coming out around the same time. We've reviewed a few of them on my show before, and we will again in the near future. This came out in June 2009. The writer on this book is Chris Yost. The artist is Mark Teixeira. Maury Hollowell helped on the cover. John Rauch is on colors, Todd Klein on letters, and Nick Lowe and Dan Ketchum are the editors. I don't know if any of you have worked with Chris Yost. I tend to really enjoy his writing for the most part, and I enjoy how he takes the complexity of Wolverine and keeps it to a pretty simple story here. And are you guys Mark Teixeira fans? Again, I associate him with the old trading cards almost more than anything.
Love Tex.
Tex fan.
I used to work over him a ton. And of course, he was always really late, so sometimes I would get faxes of his pencils and I would have to color those. But I knew his work well enough that when it was printed, you would never know that I had colored over breakdowns of Mark's pencils.
Tex is amazing. He's an amazing storyteller, an amazing artist. Just love everything that he does.
Premise of this book, the reason we're covering this one and not all of Wolverine's other, there's like 45 individual comic books that we could do just about Wolverine's origins, truly. Like, it's truly insane. But we're focusing on this one because it ties into the Giant Size X-Men stuff we're covering on the show currently in a very particular way. This book adds one very brutal piece to Wolverine's story that I think is often overlooked. But let's spend a little time talking about it. The title of this story is Birth of a Weapon. We get a cover where Wolverine is raging at the sky. He has the sharpest canines. His mask is big. He's got a red background behind him. mean, his claws are so long. Sometimes they're drawn so long, you guys. And I'm sorry to do this to all of you. It's a beautiful cover. It's a beautiful image. But I just feel like Wolverine was very constipated. And this is the moment he finally experienced relief. Like this snapshot, he had to pop the claws and now he's feeling better. Yeah,
now that I look at it that way, yeah, thanks a lot, Chad.
He's so relieved, finally. When we jump in, the very simple premise here is Wolverine is kind of flashing back to his origins, against which he has normal or new access to. We get a couple of pages based on the trauma of his past, where his parents end up dead, and the only girl who was there to save him is that little redheaded Rose, and we have this theme of redheads, from Rose to Heather Hudson to Jean Grey, and on in his life, that kind of represents that. We see Wolverine having a nightmare of that time his claws popped. He wakes up screaming Rose, but he is in a plane being ready to be deployed by Weapon X to go fight the Hulk and the Flesh Eater, we presume. So Wolverine is being thrown into action as an operative with some pilots that are very anti-mutant. As he's waking up, they're getting filthy mutant, not even human. He's an animal. We'd all be better off if he just died down there. Wolverine jumps out of the plane. Here's hoping, he says. And after that initial mission where he fights the Hulk and the Flesh Eater, he's immediately back at the base where he's being screamed at by not doing well enough. He's covered in scratch marks, but of course he has healed, and he pops his claws to threaten one of the operatives. His new military commander is a guy named Chasen. This is the guy from Giant Size X-Men number one, which is not the same guy from Incredible Hulk. That guy's name was Colonel Bernardo. We don't know what happened to him. Gregory, did you have thoughts on this opening scene of Wolverine as kind of a combat operative with nightmares?
You know, this whole issue reeks of somebody in the company saying, hey, we want to put all this stuff together. Let's get a talented writer to make it seem like it's not some sort of pandering cash grab, which is what it is. So, you know, I mean, Chris did a very nice job. He makes it very readable and it's interesting, but everything I'm reading, I'm going, geez, I wish these scenes were going on longer, because there's a lot more stuff that could be shown that we haven't seen, with, you know, them being pissed at him for not doing the thing. That should have lasted longer than just, hey, you suck, Wolverine popping his claws. There's a lot more stuff that I think could have been done, but that wasn't the purpose of this. It was, okay, you've got two pages here to constantly do this. And again, I'm very uninterested in this character now that he knows everything.
Yeah, fully understood.
You know, and it's like, okay, he knows all of everything. So I think Yost does a pretty good job of making a clever story out of, you know, what's clearly a cash grab assignment. And of course, I'm happy to look at Texas art.
We get another flashback in his memories of Wolverine in the time he was living in the Arctic as like a naked guy with a pack of wolves hunting down deer. And that went on for a while, apparently. He's just a skinny kid back then. We get that use of shadow covering his kind of naked form as he's bonded with his wolf pack, feasting on the deer, howling at the moon.
The Arctic's type of scenario, the landscape there is pretty remote, or it's pretty stark. So that worked out great. I find, of course, you know, comics code and all that, you can have him kind of be naked without, you know, fully showing things. So Mark handled that really well. Kills this deer. You see the claws going right through the neck. You know, cinematically, everything works out really well. Using that silhouette in the very final panel where he's howling with the wolves, he's one of the pack. You know, that's really the idea that you pick up there. And that's his animal nature. And that's, then you're going to jump ahead, it says Northern Canada years later. Well, Northern Canada, well, where? You know, it doesn't matter. Too much of Canada's similar up there in the winter. It's snow and ice.
Frozen...
In the summer, it's forest and black flies. You know,
we're in a frozen wasteland. Wolverine loves a remote Canadian bar. There are giant letters on this building in neon. One says beer and the other says bar. So a question for all three of you. You are in Northern Canada in an indeterminate place at this bar. What beer do you order? Promised you we'd talk about beer at Lizard a little bit today.
If I'm in Canada, I'm going to have a Molson. But it was interesting because I was skiing in Vermont one time and I met a bunch of Canadians and they were all drinking Bud. I'm like, why are you drinking Budweiser? You guys are from Canada. Why are you guys? And they're like, yeah, what you think of good beer as Molson in our area is what we think of Budweiser here. Eh?
I'm ordering pretty much what I would order anywhere. I'm going to get a brown ale, you know, unless they don't have any of that. You know, they're not a lot of Canadian beers that I'm a big fan of. I I'm much happier to have some harder liquor.
And Jeff, do they still make Molson Brador?
Yeah, I guess so. But I'd go for Alexander Keith. That's he was a brewer from living in Halifax. And when the British Navy was running that city, of course, that was at a time when part of their pay was like 5 gallons of beer a week or something. So he pretty much cornered the market on beer. And of course, as you know, in the old days, since the water supply wasn't necessarily safe, you know, putting alcohol in it was made it sterile enough to drink so you wouldn't get poisoned. And this is why, you know, you have wine and stuff going back centuries. So Alexander Keith's, that's very good stuff. Of course, the other thing here, people can always order a Guinness, you know, so if you want something a little, you know, where your spoon will stand up straight in it and it won't tip over. You can have a nice Guinness.
A few months ago, I worked as a crisis responder. I was at a little teeny remote town for a couple days, and the only bar in town, this was in Price, Utah, for anyone who's been, was like a hotel bar, and it was full of just people who looked like they had just finished hunting or working on the railroad. Like, there's deer heads on the wall. I was the pretentious queer guy in the small town who asked for an old fashioned, and what was served to me was not an old fashioned. There was some chunky fruit out of a can in it. I don't know what happened. This place gives me those vibes. The giant pink beer neon sign on the exterior like makes me laugh out loud for some reason. It's so huge. So I know it's just art, but like in my world, like the owner of this remote Canadian bar just really needs to advertise what's for sale there. Just a giant beer letters.
Yeah, but that's the whole idea is that, you know, this being comics, people were going to read the captions and they're going to glance at the pictures and move on. So while you want to give an impression of the location, you know, readers aren't going to pause, and you want them to pause and pore over the artwork necessarily. So beer bar, you know, it's very straightforward and simple and gets the point across. We will read a given image in about 1/3 of a second. So the whole idea that while I was mentioning before about adding background gives some makes the reader understand that they're not looking at their characters in a vacuum. In terms of storytelling, having like good background in like 2 panels out of 6 in a page is all you need, really. You don't need more than that.
Entire page is basically cool blues, except for this giant hot pink beer. So my eye goes right to beer. It was a very bad choice of color for that page. And, you know, almost any other color would have been better. But, you know, your eye goes right to beer. This page is not about beer.
But I do think the use of light and the snow is effective here, even though it moves quickly. So Wolverine exits the bar, and there are, like, he passes out in the snow, or he gets thrown out. I'm not exactly sure what happens, because it's talking about anti-mutant depression. There's a lot that's packed into the background of this scene, including Romulus and the Weapon X project and the Hudson family line. We're not going to go into it, but basically some soldiers show up with some guns, and they hit him with about 45 tranquilizers to knock him unconscious. And this is where Wolverine gets drawn into that Barry Windsor Smith story, which we'll cover another time on the show, where he is strapped into the tank with the tendrils feeding the adamantium into his bloodstream. He's wearing black briefs in this, which in the old Barry Windsor Smith comics, he's usually naked. But this is a gorgeous, like, 2-page spread of, like, human anatomy. Wolverine looks very, like, fit and strong. And this is the era where he is being tortured and experimented on by Abraham Cornelius, Carol Hines, and the mysterious professor. And they're fucking with his memories, and there are other operatives being experimented on. But he is in tremendous pain as the adamantium is permanently bonded to his bones, and he's only able to survive because he has his healing factor. They keep him in chains, they mess with his head, they make him fight different animals. So we get that flashback of him wearing the big red hat that has like the Cyclops looking visor, and he has to like behead a bear, so it like gets very violent here. Then we get the illusion that he broke out, he killed people, he killed a bunch of soldiers, and he escaped. Now, later we learn that those scientists were putting those memories in his head. They were not actually killed, but Wolverine's memories of that at the time is what he murdered everybody. And that's all part of the original Barry Windsor Smith story. So there's some beautiful art in this section, followed by Wolverine walking out into the wilderness and just kind of freezing over. He's walking around naked with his claws out, or, you know, the wires still attached. And this is where Heather Hudson and James find him. And there's another redhead saving him in a moment of crisis. Glenn, what were your thoughts on the flashbacks here to the Weapon X times? The art is gorgeous.
The art is spectacular, but I felt sorry sorry for Chris having to write this, but I don't think when you're doing an origin story and you're doing a recap, you don't want to do flashbacks, right? You don't want to. So the timing, you know, I'm like, wait, where am I now in this story? Where am I now in this story? And I felt sorry for anyone who wasn't a Wolverine fan, who wasn't familiar with Wolverine's background, to try to piece these things together. I mean, even going back to the beginning, you know, who is this Rose person? She's never explained. When he's jumping out to go fight the Hulk, that's never explained who he's fighting. So these are actually questions. If this is supposed to be his origin from soup to nuts, then we should see all these essential parts in chronological order, not flashbacks and going around, because I'm going, wait, where is he now? He's back in the Arctic weather here.
There's limited real estate, but they give 8 full pages to the Weapon X flashbacks, which is a lot of real estate in this book that feels very rushed.
Yeah, exactly. But I think if they tried to do it from, you know, day one, you know, when he's with, you know, the family that, you know, he supposedly thought he murdered or something like that. And he's with, you know, even if he introduced Sabretooth there, I don't know, that would have been too much. But just take it chronological rather than from Professor X's. I'm assuming, you know, all these captions are Professor X's point of view. So it's his explanation of what he was seeing at the time.
Well, and the things that are left out, right? There's no like him in the old war units. There's no him in Japan. There's no him fathering children. Like, there's a lot that's left out. So there's a lot of real estate given to that.
Yeah, Japanese things only mentioned in a caption, you know, there's the page where he's lying in the tank and there are all the like bubbles, almost like blood platelets. And it just says, you know, a process of Japanese origin, comma, he overhears. And it's like, that's it?
Yeah.
Where's the first mask he had when he first fought the Hulk?
They kind of left that out. I love it. His little short mask, it makes me happy. We move to his Department H days, and I'll introduce these characters very quickly. Heather Hudson was a 17-year-old secretary working for the government when an older scientist named James Hudson took an interest. They are married. He's twice her age. It's already uncomfortable. James is also the character's guardian and vindicator from Alpha Flight. James is also directly related to the professor of the Weapon X project, who's a guy named Truett Hudson. We'll get into all of that another time. It's a fun read, and somebody challenged me to do this once. You see Wolverine getting found by Heather in the wilderness on her honeymoon with James, and then kind of assume that they just are a throuple or like a little threesome for a while. It makes it really interesting that she brings this hot man in the woods home to her husband. I don't know. It makes me laugh. This is where Wolverine is training with the Alpha Flight operatives. This is where he's getting sent on missions, and he's living with Heather, who claims to know nothing about it, but he's having memories of violently killing people for Department H. And that's where we finally get the Hulk battle, the Flesh Eater battle, and then Professor X coming to recruit him. So there's your short mask. We get one image of Wolverine laying on a bed, and his little uniform is laying on the floor next to him. If you guys remember in the first episode of X-Men, the animated series, Wolverine's lying on a twin bed while looking at a picture of Scott and Jean, and he's like lovingly tracing a finger over it. This is giving their very that. And then Professor X is there to recruit him. Major Chasen is summoning him into the office.
It just makes me think, okay, when's the next guy going to pick up Wolverine and go, no, this is all a fake planted memory. None of this actually ever happened. We're going to do a whole series where we show you how all these stories that Wolverine was in didn't really happen. They're fine, but, you know, again, it's just, it's this sort of endless cash grabby thing that it's like, I'd like to see a little bit more of this.
This era of his history is very like Manchurian Candidate or like the Bourne supremacy, like Bourne Identity stories, right? Like the operative that's being sent into action as the program. And if you guys know the character Laura Kinney or X-23, who is the clone of Wolverine that's being written by Erica Schultz currently, it's a different version of that. She's created as a child weapon version of this character. So Wolverine goes into Chasen. This is directly from Giant Size X-Men number one. This is where Xavier is here to recruit him. I'm here. And Chasen says, you've got 5 minutes, mister. I don't care what kind of clearance you have. Xavier says, it's Professor, actually. And thank you, Major Chasen. I'll be brief. Wolverine, my name is Professor Charles Xavier. I run a school for gifted children. Do I look like a kid, bub? No, but you are a mutant, and I have desperate need of your gifts. I would like you to leave Department H and come work with me. And Chasen's furious. What? That's it. You're out. So in the original scene from Giant Size X-Men number one, this is where Wolverine goes over and he cuts off Chasen's tie. And they're like, oh, okay. This is an added scene in this book, like, that tells us what really happened. So they say they're trying to show Xavier out. Xavier instead freezes all of the soldiers' brains for a little while. Like, I'm gonna keep them here and delete their memories so that Wolverine and kind of have a moment together. So while they're in this frozen time space, who the hell are you? Someone who thinks that mutants and humans can live together in harmony, but who realizes that such a dream must be fought for. Someone who thinks you are more than a weapon to be pointed by Department H. You stay because of the kindness that James Hudson showed you. You stay because of Heather. You take Major Chasen's missions because it's all you know. But every day you wonder who you were, what you are. I can help you remember the man inside you. In time, together, we can unlock everything. All I ask is that you give me a chance to show you. Okay, now remember that story I told you earlier about there's a different story that says Xavier actually suppressed all those memories. So fuck Charles Xavier, because he's a manipulative asshole when you have to stack up all the stories in this way. We are back. The soldiers are there, and Xavier is taking Wolverine away. Wolverine is wheeling Xavier from the car to the plane. I can't decide if you're dangerous or crazy, Xavier. Are those the only options? If you know as much about me as you say, then you know there's no place for me in your dream world. The simple fact that you came with me tells me otherwise. You really think you can help an animal like we got trouble? I can sense, no, the jet is, and the military blows up.
Boom.
Then they get attacked by a full contingent of soldiers. This is not in the original story. This is the only place that's ever been explored. Xavier's got a concussion. Can't stop the soldiers. Xavier says, if they get me, they're going to learn all my secrets. Logan, you got to kill me before. And Wolverine goes, no, not you, them. We get a double snicked with his long, long, long claws in this. They're drawn so long in this series. Turns against all the operatives. They're firing tranquilizers. He hacks them to pieces, one at a time. And it ends in two soldiers trying to put a power blocker on Xavier to capture him for Department H, while Wolverine is being overwhelmed by soldiers. He breaks free. He slices their arms off. He's cutting their guns in half. He is slicing people to pieces in a berserker rage. And Xavier, with the power blocker on the ground, still handicapped, turns and sees Wolverine on top of a pile of bloody bodies. He says, dear Lord, the man called Logan was gone. He'd given in to the animal that he hated so much, and the animal wasn't done killing. Wolverine leaps at Xavier. Logan, no! Logan, listen to me. You're a man, not an animal. But if you kill me, the animal wins. I believe the man inside you is stronger. Now prove it. And Xavier is able to break Wolverine from his berserker rage. He says, thank you, Logan. Change my mind. You're definitely crazy. Now we go to them at the Xavier mansion. This is never gonna work. I'm no hero. I respectfully disagree, Logan. Whatever you may think of yourself, I owe you my life. You believe yourself an outcast, a monster, hated and feared by those around you? Then I say welcome home. Welcome to the X-Men. And the doors open and we see Cyclops, Storm, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Banshee, Sunfire, Thunderbird, all from Giant Size X-Men number one, walking in. It says the beginning at the end, which continues into the Krakoa battle. I know I just read a lot all at the same time, but this is a crazy addition to that original story. I would love to hear your thoughts on this crazy violent version of Berserker Wolverine pre-X-Men number one.
I'm glad that this is new, that this was not explored anywhere else, because it's not something that I was reading this and go, really? This happened? And so I'm glad that it was only in this story explored, because if you were Professor X and you saw this, would you take this savage being into your school and say, hey, everyone, here's my nice new friendly teammate, Wolverine. He's going to be a great addition to the team. Like, or wouldn't you be like, oh my God, who am I introducing this guy to? Why am I doing this? My students are going to be in danger every day. Maybe it's not a good idea.
Well, looking at it, looks like Mark was kind of waiting until he could really cut loose with these pages, especially starting with that double snicked. And then he has his Barry Windsor Smith Conan famous picture where he's standing in the first pile of bodies, and then it's also very Frank Frazetta, and then he's doing it, and then he gets a lot of chopping up. It's very violent. It's a lot more than you usually expect, especially from some comics with Wolverine. And then Xavier is completely shocked, and then this last pile of bodies is really it's surreal, because it's kind of unmanageable. How do you get all of a sudden 100 people all piled up, and then him him standing way on top. That kind of silly, but of course he has to have somewhere to leap to come down at Xavier. He gets him on the ground, and again, great angle, and he punches him down, but he punches the ground next to Xavier, and I can't tell if he knocked the that mine. He cut the power blocking collar off. Yeah, he cut the collar. Yeah, he broke that off. Wolverine, at least he's in character, it's never going to work, you know, because he's really reluctant to deal with these other people and all that. And then I have to say, in this one case, all the other X-Men showing up, they look kind of like posed, you know, action figures all standing there. But I guess, you know, Mark's figure, I got to get them all in one panel and they're all just walking in this room. So
got to really agree with Glenn. You know, I mean, this is the Wolverine I want to see right here. This berserker, out of control guy that can do this. But then you got to turn around and go, what in the hell is wrong with Professor X that he says, you know what? Yeah, let's bring this guy back to my little school full of people. You know, Professor X is definitely like the worst human ever, you know, between messing with people's minds without their permission and then bringing this uncontrollable character back who's, you know, and he's standing there like, oh, okay, you know, and I can't understand, believe Wolverine actually went with him, you know, so all right, did Professor X mind control him to get him?
Yes, so three quick theories I'll toss at you, and we don't know. Number one, did this not really happen, but Xavier made Logan think it would happen to win his loyalty, which is fascinating. Number two, did Xavier make the soldiers attack with his telepathy? Because with this character, you always have to ask that. But I think the more interesting read here is just how, and this is so funny in the Marvel Universe, because everyone I know from Canada is the nicest person, but Department H is the most evil place in the Marvel Universe. They've been using Wolverine to complete assassinations. Xavier goes there in quote-unquote good faith to recruit that operative, and they try to put a power blocker on him and like make Xavier their captive. So that version of the story is really interesting, and there's almost like a what-if comic that could result from there. So just kind of fucks with your head when you look at it in that way. This story fits. It's really interesting, but Wolverine leaving Canada and then Alpha Flight being sent after him later, you start to get that a little bit more too. As we look at this final page, we've been exploring just the rich diversity in Giant Size X-Men. Is there a character on that final page that's just your favorite? Who are you happiest to see in this bunch?
My favorite is Nightcrawler.
He's so great.
Yeah. The only thing is, I wish that Tex had drawn him more in a Nightcrawlerish kind of pose there. You know, to Jeff's point, everyone's very erect. They look like action figure standees. You know, here it is. You know, why not show them all in an active pose here?
After all that violence, it makes sense that everybody's erect now. I'm just kidding.
Even Storm. I'm going to go with what Mike Golden once said when somebody said, who do you, you know, which characters do you like to draw? And he says, I like them all. So I kind of like, I like them all. Sunfire, I did draw in
Submariner.
In a Submariner story. Yeah, with Glenn there. Yeah, we put Sunfire in there. That was, actually, it came out really well.
It was great.
So.
Yeah.
It's really fun.
I always like to see more Nightcrawler, but, you know, again, he's just sort of standing there. So, you know, and I like to see, I wish more was done with Sunfire.
I hope you guys had fun just nerding out and diving into, you know, Nerd Universe for a while. Jeff, it's so lovely to hear your stories and to get to know your style and your talents. I'm really excited for my Moonstone print. So as we're wrapping up, I'd love for you guys to share any final thoughts. We're going to put this out on February 10th. Where can people find each of you online? And is there anything you'd like to plug? Let's go in the order of Jeff, Greg, and then Glenn.
I just finished those two issues of Savage Sword of Conan. That would be issues 5 and 6. And otherwise, I have a website. I have a mostly Facebook presence. Website is jeffreyisherwood.ca. So a Canadian website, kind of handy with Wolverine today.
Greg, I don't even know if I told you this. I'm working on an app called HADOM, HADOM. It stands for Have a Drink on Me. And what would happen? So, Chad, if you walked into a bar and you had the app and they had it on their system, on their POS system, we're working with Clover POS right now, and if they had the Clover POS system, you'd get a notification that, Chad, you just walked into a Haddam bar. Do you want to let your friends know so they can either A, join you, or B, they can buy you a drink? So you go, yeah, I'm going to let my friends know. Boom, it goes out. Greg might get a notification and say, Chad just walked into a bar. You want to buy him a drink? You go, you know what? Yeah, I really like that podcast I did with Chad. I'm going to do boom, boom, boom. Let's send that out. And you would get a drink, a beer of your choice, or an old-fashioned, Chad.
Or terrible old-fashioned. fashion.
A terrible old fashion, yeah. So
I love it.
The website is hadom.com, H-A-D-O-M.com, and you can learn more about it there.
Have you launched it yet?
The app is available. It's not available yet. We are working with Clover right now. We're hoping in February as well.
Okay. Best place to find me is on Facebook, where I'm blathering on and on about all kinds of stuff. Currently working with Graham Nolan on Escape from Monster Island, which is a lot of fun, a lot of monsters and stuff. I'm working on a project that's sort of secret with the amazing Ron Wagner and Larry Hama, and it's a massively bloody Western that I'm really, really proud of the work that we're doing. I don't know when we'll finish. And then I got a secret project from DC that I'm working on with the mega talented Tony Harris that we'll see when that comes out.
I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. The three of you are welcome to add me, just ask. But you can follow the show, Gray Malkin_Lane on Instagram. It is a whole new year. There is a lot of crazy stuff happening all over the place, but we're going to create joy here and have fun nerding out with other nerds and creating that safe space. My kids are 16 and 13 now, and just, you know, getting busier all the time. I feel like I'm chauffeur constantly for those of you that have had teenagers. But in the middle of a business rebrand and writing my own projects, my graphic novel, Gay Mormon Dad, is going to be published by Graphic Mundi. We are in production deals. So super excited about announcements coming out regarding that. I'm always writing stories on the side. In the next episode, we have a really fun balance. We're going to be reading The Time Beast Joined the Avengers, but we're doing it as a live script reading. So I have a lot of friends who love doing voice talent acting. If you had fun with the Giant Size X-Men read through in early January, you're going to have a great time with this. So thanks everybody for listening. Thank you so much for Jeff, Greg, and Glenn for being here today. We'll see you all back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane. Thank you for listening to Gray Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Gray Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Gray Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.